Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome to the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border. Ralph Reed is with us, and we'll get to Ralph in just a second, but first I just want to let you know what's coming up on the show today. Professor Marjorie Cohen is going to drop by in a few minutes. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court decision. John Wasik, personal finance in our second hour. We're going to have a Taking Our Country Back segment. And Bob Barr is going to drop by in our third hour talking about his run as the nominee from the Libertarian Party for President of the United States. Christy Harvey will be with us at 11:30. So, and the Supreme Court has just ruled, and in fact I'd like to get Ralph Reed's thoughts on this, on that people in Guantanamo Bay actually can appeal in civilian courts. A lot of hysteria about this among the four hard right members of the court. Ralph Reed.com is his website. He's got a new book out called Dark Horse, a political thriller. Ralph, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
You are the uber GOP consultant. 7 presidential nominees, 88 congressional and gubernatorial races. Well, first of all, let's talk about your book, and then we can get into politics. I certainly want to give you your due for showing up here with us. I appreciate that. This book, what I find amazing about this, and I'm curious how you deal with some of these things in it, because I've not read the book. I've read the summary on your webpage, actually, at ralphreed.com, along with, you know, a few others, is, you know, the female vice president, the African-American president, or nominee, rather, it seems like it's George W. Bush versus Barack Obama in pantomime almost, or in an alternate universe. And the sitting president trying to talk Israel out of attacking Iran, I mean, at what point does life start? I mean, here you have art imitating life, but at what point does life begin imitating art?
Well, you know, it's really kind of bizarre because I sat down, Tom, and started writing Dark Horse in the fall of 2006. I mean, keep in mind at that point, Barack Obama had only been in the U.S. Senate for a little more than 18 months.
Yeah.
I didn't even know if he was going to run for president, much less that he would win the Democratic nomination. There hasn't been a Democratic nomination that went all the way to the convention in 50 years. And yet Dark Horse has a Democratic nomination that goes all the way to the convention. First African-American major party nominee in American history. First woman to be on a ticket since 1984, which, by the way, I do believe will happen this year in at least one and maybe both parties. I can't claim any particular clairvoyance. I thought what everybody else thought, that Hillary Clinton would be the Democratic nominee if she was breathing.
Yeah.
I guess I just kind of got lucky, but I can tell you that even though I'm probably either too young or too loyal to write a memoir, I mean, I just can't write a kiss and tell after advising somebody who later becomes president. Everything that happened in this book, even though it's a novel, is true, and it either happened to me or somebody else.
Oh, that's interesting. That's very interesting. I'm curious then how, either in your book or frankly in your life, as a political consultant, as a Christian, as a person who I assume believes in repentance, your character or yourself have thought about or counseled colleagues in the Republican Party to repentance and ask for forgiveness for helping organize the mass murder that we call war, apparently purely for political reasons in the case of George W. Bush?
You mean with respect to Iraq?
Yes.
Well, I think that that with regard to Iraq, I think we've had this studied by about four separate commissions, including by one in Britain, including a bipartisan report from the Senate Intelligence Committee. And what all of them found was that the intelligence upon which not only our government, but other governments around the world relied, which indicated that Saddam Hussein had stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons and was seeking...
I'm not buying that, Ralph. I'm sorry. You could, I mean, maybe you could sell that on Fox News, but there were a lot of us who were looking at this, and the majority, by the way, of Democrats in the House of Representatives voted against authorization for this thing. There were a lot of us who were looking at the intelligence out there and listening to Hans Blix, who was there in Iraq, saying, there's nothing here.
That's fine, and there were plenty of people who opposed the war, like John Corzine, the U.S. Senator from New Jersey, who
sure.
I had the opportunity to talk to about it. But
the bottom line is, you don't feel that there is a level of guilt among Republicans.
Dick Gephardt, the Democratic leader in the House, co-sponsored the resolution.
Oh, I know. Hillary Clinton voted for it. I think all of them should be asking for forgiveness.
George W. Bush's doorstep. I mean, Edwards voted for it. Kerry voted for it. Hillary voted for it.
Right, and I would counsel all of them to ask for forgiveness and repent. And I'm just wondering if you think that that's something that the Republican Party and you and your colleagues should do.
No, and I'll tell you why. Because that was not the only basis of the military action. The other basis of the military action was the fact that he was one of the leading state sponsors of terrorism in the world, and we now know from both the United Nations.
I'm not buying that either, Ralph.
Well, let me just give you the facts, okay? If you're not buying it, let me just tell you what the facts are. It is a documented fact that he paid the North Korean government $10 million for long-range missile technology.
That he was buying from them. He bought the missiles, and then we went in and destroyed them. I mean,
It is a documented
He was paying the families of suicide bombers. It was a terrible thing.
Tom, can I finish my point?
Sure, Ralph.
Can you at least let me finish?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, he had a clandestine biological network of chemical and biological laboratories that were working on WMD programs. And he was developing missile technology that would have allowed him to fire a missile into any capital in Europe. He was paying $25,000 cash bounties to the family of any terrorist who exploded themselves in Israel. And, you know, he started the bloodiest war in the modern history of the Middle East, the Iran-Iraq war, which caused over a million casualties.
Which he
lost. I think the world is better without Saddam Hussein running Iraq. I supported the war then. I support it now. I agree with John McCain that I think the way we handled the aftermath of removing him from power was a failure.
Yeah. I'm so sad to hear that, Ralph. I'm curious. Do the characters in your book deal with this moral dilemma?
Well, the dilemma that they're dealing with is not unlike the dilemma that our government is dealing with now, which is you have the leading state sponsor of terrorism in the world, namely Iran, which is on the verge of weaponizing a nuclear device. And Israel's, I may have this wrong, it may have been either their, yeah, I know it wasn't Tivney, the foreign minister, but I believe either the defense minister or a member of the cabinet has said that if the United States does not act, that Israel will act.
Yeah, I've seen the news reports. So you're not concerned about, you know, Saudi Arabia, for example, running fundraisers for Al-Qaeda and things like that, the enormous amounts of money that have gone to support quote terrorists and particularly Al-Qaeda out of our ally countries. You're not concerned about Osama bin Laden hanging out in Pakistan and are still supporting Pakistan.
I think this
assertion that Iran is
about that, Tom. But what I talk about in Dark Horse is something that I think is a much likely crisis that is going to land on the desk of whoever is elected president in November.
Yeah.
Whoever walks into that Oval Office on January 20th, 2009, regardless of their politics or what party they're a member of, is going to have to deal with whether or not we are prepared to abide the leading state sponsor of terrorism being a nuclear power in the Middle East.
Assuming that they actually are the leading state sponsor of terrorism and assuming that that's actually a major problem. I mean, there's certainly more people every day in the world who die of famine than have ever died from terrorism. Well, I mean, every day you die from
hunger. We know that they're the leading funder of Hezbollah. We know they're the leading funder
of
Hamas.
Don't you think as Christians we should be most concerned with the fact that there are people, there are far more people than have died in all the terrorist attacks in your lifetime and mine, Ralph. More people die from hunger and preventable disease every day. Isn't that the Matthew 25 question?
Sure, absolutely. But I don't see it as an either or.
Why not?
Of course we should be concerned about ameliorating poverty and AIDS and malnourishment on the sub-Saharan continent. We should do things about the genocide in Sudan, in the Darfur region. I applaud what the president has done through his AIDS initiative.
What George Bush is doing is he's supporting Bashir in the north. I was just there two months ago.
Listen, George W. Bush has led the way on a $15 billion investment on eradicating AIDS from the African continent.
Yeah. I salute him. I just, you know, hope that the money actually gets spent. Ralph, we're out of time, but fascinating concept for your book. I'm sure many people are looking forward to it. RalphRead.com. The book is Dark Horse. Ralph, thanks for dropping by today.
You bet, Tom. Good to be with you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Truth in Broadcasting.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Ralph Reed's song.
God wished him to be our leader. The court could not but follow suit.
Oh, the court just had to follow suit.
Right. Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Now that, Paul Weyrich. So, anyway, welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Great bumper. Marjorie Cohen is with us. Marjorie, we were just talking with Ralph Reed. In fact, I had intended to ask him about the Supreme Court decision. We just never got into it. He was so busy telling us that we have to strike Iran. Marjorie is president of the National Lawyers Guild, Professor Thomas Jefferson School of Law, where she teaches criminal law and procedure, evidence, and international human rights law. She's also the author of the new book, Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. You can find all about her and her books and everything else over at MarjorieCohen, CoHN.com. And Marjorie, welcome.
My pleasure, Tom, as usual.
We always love having you here. You are the person to go to for anything that has to do with the Constitution, particularly the Supreme Court here. Just this morning, the news story breaking in a 5-4 vote, Anthony Kennedy, the swing vote, writing for the court, saying the laws and Constitution are designed to survive and remain in force in extraordinary times. Already the headlines are showing up on the right-wing blogs, Supreme Court votes for terrorists.
Well, of course, and that's what Scalia says as well. But, you know, we're not talking about protecting the United States against terrorists here. The overwhelming majority of men and boys who were taken to Guantanamo had nothing to do with the war on terror or Al-Qaeda or Taliban or anything else.
Right. And
they were sold as bounty to the United States, many of them for $5,000 a head.
Yeah, which is, you know, the equivalent of hundreds of thousands of dollars in U.S. money in terms of what it can buy you, you know, years of a decent lifestyle in Afghanistan. Let's explain what the decision is.
Okay, the Supreme Court held that the Guantanamo detainees have a constitutional right to habeas corpus to test the legality of their detention, and that the current scheme for reviewing the designations of enemy combatant and status review tribunals is not an adequate substitute for habeas corpus. Mm-hmm. Basically, what the Supreme Court did was to overturn a provision of the military Act that stripped the Guantanamo detainees from habeas corpus. And they said that you've got to give them habeas corpus, which means taking them before a neutral, independent federal judge and deciding whether they're being correctly held as enemy combatants. You either have to give them habeas corpus or come up with an adequate substitute procedure for habeas corpus.
Right. That substitute procedure part gives me the willies, because habeas corpus is pretty explicitly in our Constitution. It shall only be suspended during times of insurrection or invasion.
Yeah, and well, there's two different issues here, Tom. One is whether or not the prisoners at Guantanamo have that constitutional right to habeas corpus under the suspension clause, and a majority, five justices of the Supreme Court, said yes, they do have a constitutional right to habeas corpus. Then the second issue is, given the fact that they have a constitutional right to habeas corpus, is there an adequate substitute for habeas corpus? Is there another procedure that will give them the same protections as habeas corpus? Congress had set up, and this was the Republican-controlled Congress, in both the Detainee Treatment Act and the Military Commissions Act, was to set up a procedure for a federal court to review the decisions of the Combatant Status Review Tribunal. The Combatant Status Review Tribunal are worse kangaroo courts than the military commissions. Military commissions are criminal courts set up to try people at Guantanamo for crimes. The Combatant Status Review Tribunals are kangaroo courts to decide whether someone's an enemy combatant. You have a no right to counsel, only a personal representative who can argue for the government and doesn't have to keep confidential anything you say. And then once you get, so say you're found to be an enemy combatant under the Combatant Status Review Tribunal, then you can go into federal court, but the review in federal court is limited to the issue of whether the Combatant Status Review Tribunals followed its own kangaroo procedures.
Right.
The federal court can't say, this guy should be cut loose, he's not an enemy combatant.
Right.
That's
isn't the bottom line here, Marjorie Cohen, that the court, and we have just a minute left, I'm sorry, that the court ruled this morning in a 5-4 decision that the Constitution still stands as the ultimate law of the land, the rule of the land in the United States, and that if any of these five members who voted in favor of the, I mean, there's a 5-4, if any of these are replaced by right-wingers, if McCain becomes president, this will fall.
Precisely. This case is the poster child for how delicately the court is now balanced and the disastrous consequences to the doctrine of separation of powers that await us if a President McCain makes good on his promise to appoint judges in the mold of Roberts and Alito.
Yeah, because these guys Chief Justice Roberts says this is the most generous set of procedural protections ever afforded aliens detained by this country's enemy combatants. The phrase enemy combatants doesn't even appear in the Constitution.
And, no, it does not.
And habeas corpus is not, and all constitutional privileges are not just limited to citizens, it's people. I mean, it's just, anyway.
Every person.
There you go. Marjorie Cohen, you read all about it. Marjorie, CoHN.com, her website. Professor Marjorie Cohen, thanks so much for dropping by.
My pleasure, Tom.
Always great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. And yesterday we got all swept up with Peter Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary and totally spaced announcing our winner, although Sean did pick one out of her favorite post on our blog that you'll find the show blog for today over at tomhartman.com. And so JGM Design is the screen name. And he said, I'm one of those middle-class subprime mortgage holders. He says, send me the book screwed, because I'm one of those subprime mortgage holders who's seen his payment double in the last year as my equity sinks deep into the negative. I feel like the veteran of an undeclared war, and I want to know what I can do about it. So, bushwhacked in Rhode Island, and hoping to whack back. Good on you, John. So we're sending you a copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. And today's contest will be for a copy of my book, Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. And you just go to TomHartmann.com, and Sean will figure out whatever she thinks is the very best, her favorite post for today, and we'll give that person a book at the very end of the day. Our phone number, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Charlie in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Charlie, what's on your mind today? Listen, on Wins 940.
Hey, Tom. You know, it's oddly appropriate that you had Ralph Reed on a day after it became revealed that the House has a report that Bush met with Jack Abramoff almost a dozen times. There are actually 6 photos of it, and the White House has first claimed he only met him once and then twice. And Ralph Reed is so up to his ears with Abramoff that the K Street
poster. Oh, well, that cost him the lieutenant governorship of Georgia. I mean, you know, he ran for the number 2 position in Georgia, and all that Abramoff stuff came out, and that cost him that election.
They don't pay any penalty. It seems to me that they're disgraced, they're criminals, and yet they run around free and get book deals.
Well, that was my point. That was why I asked him, you know, are you seeking forgiveness? Are you asking for repentance? And I was frankly shocked that he wasn't. Charlie, thanks. You know, good point and well made. Gus in Huntington Beach. Hey, Gus.
Hey, Tom. Good morning. I had a whole different rant to come forth with, but this caught my attention. I didn't realize this was Ralph Reed, but I just want to talk about along the lines of cracking the code, and this is something that now I haven't read your book. I will read it, but just through book reviews and notes and things like that, you mentioned verbal and nonverbal cues.
Right.
And I'd also like to mention the underlying message of subtext by example. And what I mean by this is there's the verbal communication, which, you know, his narrative is basically that, which is a narrative that's being bandied about a lot right now about going into Iran, is let everybody knows or everybody knew. You know,
right.
It's kind of like the...
Right, it's the presumption of reality.
Right, and it's kind of like a sophisticated update of high school gossip.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're falling into that trap.
Well, that's why I kept saying, you know, I'm not buying it. We're not, you know, it's
right.
I don't believe
you're
it.
You're kind of, you know, you're kind of skimming the surface, but really the subtext is, oh, he says he's a Christian. Neoconservatives say they're for democracy, but really by their fruits you shall know them. And
yeah,
he has spent
absolutely
his whole adult life trying to garner power. And
well, Gus, I don't think it's your job or mine, either one of us, to sit in judgment of anybody else, although we can certainly have opinions about them. But, you know, Ralph isn't here to defend himself, so I'd rather not make it personal about him. But I think that we can both agree that, broadly speaking, there's been a mind-boggling amount of hypocrisy in the Republican Party.
Well, that's
and
a
that
nice,
they
that's
have,
a nice
and,
general
and,
statement.
And they have a tremendous amount of blood on their hands right now. And there's some Democrats who go along with
okay,
it.
Okay, I guess I'm being cut off.
Well, okay. If you want, Gus, I'm sorry. Jeff in Orange County, California. Hey, Jeff.
I'm sorry you didn't give Gus the entire hour to just spew that.
Well, you know, Gus is a good guy.
It's also timely to have Ralph Reed on, and I find it a little bit humorous. I think a part of maybe it's his strategy or, you know, generally in the Republican Party, no matter what fact or number you espouse, yours are wrong and theirs are right.
Yeah, this is what
I agree. He had to tell John Stewart that the number John was espousing regarding Barack Obama's, I guess, inroads into the evangelicals at 40%. Oh, no, I think your numbers are wrong, John. I think your numbers are wrong because John McCain is getting 60 to 65%. Well, wow. Ralph Reed, do you not understand basic math?
Right, the other
so
side of 60 is 40.
Well, in fact. But no, John's number, and I think that's a part of the strategy. No matter what the liberal says, make sure the audience hears that his facts are false, period.
Yeah.
No matter, even if you say, no, it's not red, John, it's red, John.
Yeah. No, absolutely, and that's yeah, and I think that we've...
That you started to try and get him to talk about Saudi Arabia. Isn't that really who attacked us on 9/11?
Yeah, if you want to tie it to a country, yeah, 17 of the terrorists,
exactly.
Absolutely.
And
yeah,
they
Jeff...
are the ones who Bush is dancing with. who are benefiting the most from the oil being at the price that it's
And over $1 billion have been transferred from Saudi Arabia and Saudi interests and Saudi families, Jeff, to the Bush family or companies associated with the Bush family over the last 30 years. It is mind-boggling, and you know, we just need to be calling this stuff out. John in New Orleans, Louisiana, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it says N-O. I think it's L-A, but anyway, yeah.
Yeah, it's so refreshing to talk to people like you because we don't get progressive talk in New Orleans anymore.
Yeah.
So the question I have is that sometimes the left would call the people on the right Bible thumpers. How come the people on the right don't call the people on the left Constitution thumpers? If that's all they like to talk about is Constitution this, Constitution that.
Yeah.
And like, it's funny, the right likes to, they like to marginalize the Constitution a lot, but they're never willing to just outright blast the Constitution, saying that the Constitution is old, it's ancient, we don't need that anymore. This is a time.
Well, actually, there have been some times when the guys on the right have said that it needs to be updated. This is actually, you know, I mean, Bush talked about that a lot in the context of his breaking the FISA laws, you know, that these laws and were, you know, from the 70s, and that was an old time. And then the subtext for that for the commentators became, well, the Constitution's 200 years old, and that's probably old stuff, too. And it doesn't, you know, they didn't have terrorism back then. Well, maybe not, but the British actually invaded the United States in 1812 and marched all, you know, from Canada, the British and the Canadians. Yes, we started the war. I'll acknowledge that for all the Canadians who are going to now, you know, email me. But and marched all the way down to Washington, D.C. and burned the White House, and maybe one of the dreams of these guys on 9/11. But they didn't do that. I mean, so I would say the Constitution has withstood a lot. John, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Tim in Detroit. Hey, Tim.
Okay.
Tim, you're on the air.
Yeah. All right. How you doing?
I'm fine. What's up?
I'm okay. I just wanted to ask a question. He was talking about how Saddam had a nuclear, what biological and chemical weapons. He was saying.
He said that Saddam was researching them or had labs that could do the research. You know, it was nonsense. It was.
But the question is, don't we have that?
Yeah. Yeah, we do. But we have it legally.
Okay,
the UN says that we can have it.
Another question then.
Sure.
Okay, we got nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons.
Right.
And plus, we invaded somebody on lies and on all kind of lies. Everybody that's finding out, I already knew they was lying, but everybody else trying to, they late. They're finding out now that they lie.
Yeah.
So we invaded somebody based on lies. We got chemical, biological, nuclear weapons, but they got the nerve to talk about what's down.
I know. I was frankly astounded that he was still peddling that, Tim, and I appreciate the call and your comments. I did not expect that. I fully did not expect that. And it's a testimony to how deep in denial I think some of these folks are. Whatever. It's not my place to judge Ralph, particularly at least when he's not here to defend himself. I try to hold to that moral standard or whatever on this program. Scott in Alameda, California. Hey, Scott.
Yeah, Reed mentioned that everybody believed the same thing from the intelligence. The fact
right,
that
and I pointed out to him that everybody didn't. In fact, the majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives said no.
Right. But the fact is that the intelligence community came out with their, you know, whatever it is, their threat assessment.
Mm-hmm.
It usually takes like a year and a half to write.
Right.
Cheney rejected it and had a new one written in something like 6 weeks.
Yeah, yeah,
okay, and
Cheney was,
and they changed one or two little words.
Yeah, and Cheney was cherry picking intelligence. No, absolutely, Scott. I mean, this is just a classic destruction of reality in the United States, and the fact that neoconservatives and right wingers and people who participated in this are not backing down, and in fact, if anything, are pushing for more wars. From John Bolton to Ralph Reed, right across the board, the fact that that's going on raises in my mind the question that Peter Yarrow raised yesterday on this program, Peter, Paul, and Mary, who now at the age of 70 is a very active activist out there, peterpaulandmary.com, by the way, which is, Do we need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission? Do we need an opportunity, a healing opportunity for this country where we can say to people, okay, you're a war criminal, admit it, come clean about it, we'll work through it, we'll get past it? Or do we need to just go into full-blown, full-tilt boogie prosecution mode? What's going to be better for this country? For us to get revenge and right the wrongs of the Constitution? Or for us to recorrect the Constitution, fix those wrongs in a way that's less vengeful, like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission? I think it's a great question. I don't know the answer, frankly.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's one of my favorite songs from back home, Home on the Range. Oh, give me a home where no liberals roam, and the folks all think the same way. Where each house has a gun, a big caliber one, and strangers are told, make my day. Home. Cantaloupe lane, where seldom is heard a three-syllable word, or so that it's one I can say. All right.
Thank you, George. Yeah. Oh, amazing. Well, speaking of George and his friends, our conservative alert for the day. In Washington State, under this new two-tier, top-two primary system that they have, candidates can list their party affiliation any way they want. In other words, it doesn't automatically say Republican after your name if you're a member of the Republican Party. So Dino Rossi, the guy who lost last time against Christine Gregoire and is going to run against her again, has decided not to list himself as a Republican. He's listing himself as the GOP party. Absolutely, totally strange. Dino Rossi, our wacky conservative of the day. I'm telling you, it just doesn't get any stranger than that. And anyhow, Angie Hicks is with us. Angie'sList.com, the website. We highlight advertisers on the show from time to time, people who have advertised on Progressive Talk Radio, A, so that they can get their message out, and B, so they can talk about their experience in using Progressive Talk Radio as a medium to get their message out, hopefully to encourage other people to advertise on Progressive Talk Radio right across the board. And so our format is, you know, a minute about what you're doing and a minute about your success. And we have with us today, Angie Hicks, the founder of Angie's List, a word-of-mouth network for consumers. Hey, Angie.
Hi, how are you?
Just great. Great to have you with us. Angie'sList.com, of course, the website. And tell us about Angie's List.
Well, Angie's List is a place you can go to get the real scoop on local service companies, whether you're looking for someone to do some home improvement projects, repair your car, take care of your pet. We even collect ratings on doctors. And all the information comes from consumers who've actually used the companies. So it's nothing that companies put themselves on or pay to be on. So it's truly the consumer's view of these service companies. So it's a great way to find out who's providing great service in town and who you might want to avoid.
That's great, and that's at Angie'sList.com. And your experience advertising on Progressive Talk Radio?
You know, it's been great for us. It's been really responsive. You know, we've got a couple of different flights with you folks. We couldn't be more pleased with how it's working out for us. It's been a really good audience.
It's been an investment that has returned a profit for you?
Absolutely.
That's great. That's great. Okay, people can read all about it over at Angie'sList.com. Angie Hicks. Angie, thanks so much, the founder, for dropping by today.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 52 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Don in Greenfield, Massachusetts, listening on WHMT. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to share a quote from Ernest Hemingway who's a guy that probably is well thought of on the right. I picked it up out of our local newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
It said, "Never think for a moment that, however necessary or justified a war is, that it is not a crime."
Yeah.
And,
well, absolutely. The point that I keep making is that we have to keep in mind that war is the one time
Well, outside of capital punishment, which I also oppose. But war is the one time, well, even this even goes beyond capital punishment, where we sanction, legally sanction, mass murder, including the murder of people who are absolutely innocent. We give legal immunity to our military, to ourselves essentially, to commit mass murder. And there has to be an enormously high threshold before that happens.
Yeah, well, I heard one theologian talk, and he said, you know, whenever there's war, it may be that we don't know what else to do. But instead of saying God's on our side, we should be praying for forgiveness because for our lack of insight.
Yeah, absolutely. It's
okay. Thanks for your show, Tom.
Thank you, Don. I appreciate the call. You know, yeah. And do we do a reconciliation commission? Do we do criminal prosecutions? Do we do both? Will one lead to the other? How do we deal with the fact that we have war criminals among us and that one of them is the president of the United States at the moment? Rex in Castro Valley, California. Hey, Rex, listening on Green 960. Rex, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hey, Rex.
Oh, hi. Listen, Mr. Halpin.
This is Tom. You're on the air.
Tom Young?
Okay. Rex, I think you're lost. Tarek in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Hey, Tarek, what's up?
Hey, yeah. I just wanted to quote something from out of the book of 1 Corinthians 2:15. It says, but he that is spiritual judges all things, yet he himself is judge of no man. Mm-hmm. And then you got to look at this 1 Corinthians. It says, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, do you not know that the saints shall judge the world? And if the world shall be judged by you, you are not worthy. Are you unworthy to judge the small?
Oh, I know. And you know, the Sermon on the Mount is all about don't judge people. But, Tarek, what's your point?
The point, well, the guy was talking about he's a Christian, this, that, and the third. Well, if this is the book he used, I mean, I heard a man say something real smart. If we're going to look at history, we're going to know that these are wise things that are going on.
Mm.
Then, and we're not going to listen to them. Yeah. Hey, we also just take Prozac or something like that. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, good point. Tarek, thank you very much. Caleb in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Caleb, got a minute here before we get to wrap up this hour.
Yeah, you know, another great show. About Angie's List, my wife had people in to do floors and railings, and she loves it. You know, in terms of what to do with Bush and Company, you quote the Nuremberg Tribunals a lot, and you're absolutely correct. We have to display and fillet these folks out for everyone to see as a warning, not for it to happen again.
I think that that's the only way that we can prevent it. I mean, we started this precedent with the pardon, with Gerry Ford's pardon of Richard Nixon, and then the decision of the Clinton administration not to prosecute, not to continue the investigations, and not to pursue prosecutions against the Iran-Contra guys from the former Bush administration and the Reagan administration. And it's time to stop.
Right.
It's time to say future administrations have to look into what, and Caleb, thanks a lot for the call, future administrations have to look into the crimes that were committed by previous administrations. The worst they had, they dragged everything out on Bill Clinton. You know, and the worst they were able to get him on was Monica Lewinsky. And then after he left the White House, they claimed, and it turned out they just completely made it up. This was something that was made up on the right-wing blogosphere, but is still believed as an urban legend, that they took all the W's off the keyboards in the White House. I mean, that was like their crime, right? And they still made a big deal about it. I think we need to point them out. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
News without conflicts of global corporate interests.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
Your home for truth in broadcasting.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. The Bank for International Settlements. This is sort of the central bank for the central banks. It's the organization that pulls together all the central banks of the world and you know, works with them, helps them cooperate, coordinate their efforts and things like that. They issue a quarterly report about basically the state of the world, the state of health of the world. And this from an article in Banking Times, which is the official daily industry newsletter of the banking industry. In Banking Times. You can read it over at bankingtimes.co.uk. So the headline, Central Bank Body Warns of Great Depression. Story by Gil Montina. The Bank for International Settlements, the organization that fosters cooperation between central banks, has warned that the credit crisis could lead world economies into a crash on a scale not seen since the 1930s. In its latest quarterly report, the body points out that the Great Depression of the 1930s was not foreseen, and the commentators on the financial turmoil instigated by the U.S. subprime mortgage crisis may not have grasped the level of exposure that lies at its heart. According to the Bank of International Settlements, complex credit instruments, a strong appetite for risk, rising levels of household debt, and long-term imbalances in the world currency system all form part of the loose monetarist policy. Let me just add, loose monetarist is like Milton Friedman on steroids. That's what's happened. That could result in another Great Depression. The report points out that between March and May of this year, interbank lending continued to show signs of extreme stress and that this was could be set to continue well into the future. They also raised concerns about the Chinese economy, whether they were repeating the mistakes that Japan made in the 1980s with their bubble economy, and whether this could lead to another Great Depression. Strange times. John Wasik. John, welcome. How do I say your last name? I'm sorry.
Wasik,
thank you. John Wasik is with us. John Wasik, WASIK.com, the website. He is the author and personal finance columnist for Bloomberg News. His most recent book, iMoney, and you can find all about it at his website, John, WASIK.com. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You're welcome, and thanks for showing up. You do a lot of writing on personal finance and how people can deal with this kind of stuff. I mean, we're looking down the throat of what might be another Great Depression. It might just be a limping along. The U.S. dollar's in the toilet. They're talking about the head of Gazprom day before yesterday, the Russian oil company, was talking about $250 a barrel oil. We're seeing gasoline at $4 a gallon, although George Bush was shocked 3 months ago when he was told that this might be coming. What's the average person to do? We talked with Ravi Batra, an economist, about the macroeconomics of this. I'm curious about the microeconomics. What should be the personal financial strategies given these times?
Well, the biggest thing is to keep in mind that the government is lying about inflation. I've been critical of this for years. The CPI doesn't reflect the impact upon the modern American family. It's just it's so vastly understated. It's laughable. I've done a few columns on this, and Kevin Phillips quoted me in his new book Bad Money on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of making the rounds that, you know, the government isn't really close to telling people how this is impacting people. So you really have to keep in mind that inflation is the ogre.
Yeah, and the reason why they're doing that, by the way, I mean, there have been three or four adjustments in the way inflation is measured over the last two decades, and it seems to me, and you're the expert on this, it seems to me that the main reason why is because there are things like Social Security that are indexed to the CPI, to the inflation index, essentially, the consumer price index, and that they don't want to have to pay out more money.
Well, that's the main reason. The other reason is that you have all these government securities that are indexed to it as well.
Oh, right. And we've got a $9 trillion debt.
Right. And the government doesn't want to have to pay out any more than it has to. So it comes up with this official measure of what they think the cost of living is. However, it doesn't reflect the true cost of home ownership. They have this goofy little metric in the CPI called rent ownership equivalent index, and it's like some economist dreaming, saying, well, what would your home cost if you rented it out? It's like,
Right. Excuse
me, you're not renting it out, you're living in it.
Right.
Paying a mortgage,
right,
and you're seeing higher property taxes, and that's not even figured into it. So
yeah, and what would your food cost if you only ate once a week?
Yeah, I mean, it's nutty. It's just absolutely insane.
Yeah.
And you know, that's the index that they tell people. This is, you know, 3-4%. That's insane.
Yeah, I think my guess is, and Kevin Phillips had an article about this a couple of weeks ago, and I forget where, but he might have been quoting you, suggesting that the actual inflation numbers for the U.S. right now are probably in the neighborhood of 10-12%.
Oh,
real inflation.
And whenever I I cover this subject, I tell people, look, forget about the CPI. What is your personal rate of inflation? How much is your income keeping up with your expenses?
So what do people do about it? So we're talking with John Wasik, WASIK.com. John, what do people do about it?
Well, first of all, you have to recognize that it's a problem. If your income is not keeping up with your expenses, you always have the option of cutting some of those expenses, looking at discretionary items, going out to eat, driving less. That's a huge factor that adds up. Always look at things that people don't even consider, such as your property taxes. If you think that you're overassessed, you can appeal your taxes, and often there are mistakes that the assessor counts on you not even protesting. So,
you
know, go ahead.
Or if the value of your property goes down, can you appeal it? I mean, as a result of the market going down?
I mean, I'm also part of a nonprofit group that's oriented towards telling people how to do this. If you've refinanced, if you want to go out and get an appraisal, a professional appraisal, bring it into your assessor or your county assessor and say, look, here's the market value of my home. You guys aren't even close. Let's get a downward adjustment.
Right.
So you always go after the big ticket stuff first.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you're saying go after the big ticket stuff and at the same time look for all the little things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can go over your credit card bill, your checking account statement,
right.
And believe me, it's always pretty revealing as to the little stuff that constantly adds up. You know, going out for a cup of coffee.
Are we at the point where your best advice to Americans is to seriously consider a radical recalibration of their lifestyle, like downsize, like, you know, move into a smaller house or apartment, cut back to just basic cable, dump the extra phone lines or whatever. I mean, it's just major. I'm not sure that those are major changes, but certainly moving into a smaller house or moving to a place where you can walk to work, those kinds of things.
Well, these things are incredibly important. And what most people don't realize is that the energy picture is only going to get worse, and not in the most visible ways. Natural gas is creeping up, and that's not even on the radar screen. We're having to import natural gas now because most of it is being consumed in terms of making electricity. So that's going to make that expensive. It's going to make home heating costs go up. I mean, they hit another record last winter, and there were record numbers of people applying for energy assistance. So that's kind of off the radar screen, and you know, a lot of the focus is on crude oil prices and gasoline, but hey, every energy cost has gone up.
Quick thoughts on investment strategies, John, for people who might have money in a 401k or an IRA?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the best way to do some sort of inflation protection is either through Treasury inflation protected securities. These are government bonds that give you a premium if inflation goes up. So unlike regular bonds, which go down when inflation goes up, tips.
But I've noticed that some of the bond funds that are just invested in those have actually gone down in the last couple months.
Yeah. Why
is that?
The bond market has been going back and forth. There's been a lot of speculation that inflation is not as bad. The Fed's got it under control. I don't believe it. I don't, you know, I don't think the market reflects the total reality there.
Right.
There's another fund called the PIMCO Commodity Total Return Fund, which invests in commodities and tips.
Mm-hmm.
So if you see oil prices, gasoline prices, any commodity going up, you will get a little bump in that. So that's like my big inflation.
Might we not be at the top end of a commodities bubble, or do you think that this has just started?
Well, long term, I think energy prices are going to go up. But I think that there's a bubble? Yeah, I think there is in crude oil.
Yeah.
I think the speculators have gotten a hold of that one, and what they're doing is they're doing an arbitrage trade against the dollar.
Right.
Every time the dollar falls, oil goes up, so they're making a killing.
They're jacking it as hard as they can. Interesting. So touch that one if you want to get your fingers burned, I guess.
Absolutely.
John Wasik, WASIK, JOHNWASIK.com is website. John, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks so much.
And his most recent book, iMoney. Check it out. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
segment of the population out there that have figured out our monitoring capabilities and they're not happy about it, sir.
Well, it's too late for them to do anything about it. Take them a message, would you?
Yes, sir. What is it?
Every step you take, every rule you break, every job you take, and every dime you make, we'll be watching you.
Sounds like Mr. Cheney.
Go astray. If you disobey, if you run away, we'll know right away because we're watching you.
Very good, sir.
Most of you don't see.
It's the British Cheney. Oh, my.
You don't have a say. We took your rights away.
Ah, but the Supreme Court gave them back today.
Don't obey. We'll put you away. Because we're watching you.
Yeah. Welcome back. Welcome back. It's 22 minutes past the hour. And strange news out there. I'll tell you, just a bottom line here. If you're going to steal something, don't try to steal a forklift and then drive it on a highway. It's like, you know, Todd Barnes, not the brightest guy in the world, apparently. Boynton Beach Boulevard, going up in Palm Beach Post article. This guy trying to steal a forklift and driving it up Federal Highway. He got 1 mile. Right at what, about 8 miles an hour? It just doesn't work. Getting back to economics here. There was a piece in the New Yorker, in the May 26th issue of the New Yorker, and this is the unreconstructed Reaganomics, Milton Friedman economics, Bushonomics, conservative GOP economic, the free trade, the pro-corporate agenda, the DLC agenda. This is their economic take. And James Surowiecki, and it's called The Free Trade Paradox. And he points out that 2 weeks ago, well, it was 2 weeks ago when he wrote the piece, and this is from the May 26th issue. He says, both Senators Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton signed on as sponsors of a new bill that would effectively impose higher tariffs on China if it doesn't revalue its currency. Now, what this is all about is that as China keeps the yuan, their currency, low with respect to the dollar, it keeps Chinese imports cheap. It used to be that we decided which countries we were willing to import goods from and which goods from those countries to encourage imports or discourage imports with specific tariffs. And there's still over 22,000 specific tariffs on the books, but the average percentage of a tariff is in the United States right now is around 2%. Tariffs are basically import taxes, where we say, okay, if you want to import that into the United States, yeah, it's going to cost you 2% to bring it in. And we used to have tariffs as high as 100%, 200%, 20%, 30%, 50%. They were all over the place, depending on whether or not we wanted to protect that industry in the United States. Or if we simply wanted to level the playing field. So if labor is cheaper in another country or commodities are cheaper in another country, we would impose a tariff so we'd still have that business in the United States. We did away with that stuff during the Reagan administration. We did away with that stuff during the subsequent George Bush administration. We did away with that stuff in big ways during the Clinton administration with NAFTA and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, which led to the World Trade Organization. And we did away with it even more under the Bush administration. There's been this steady decline since Reagan was elected in tariffs and thus in the protection of American industry, American business, including small business or particularly small business and American workers. So anyhow, this guy in this article in the New Yorker points out that he says the specific products that middle and low income Americans buy are much more likely to originate in places like China than the products that wealthier Americans buy. In other words, people who are on a budget, they're shopping at Walmart. They have no choice. Whereas wealthy Americans, and the example he uses is Louis Vuitton bags and Patek Philippe watches and all that kind of thing, they're buying, or BMW cars, they're buying, or Cadillacs, they're buying products made in the United States or Europe, high-wage countries. So he says the rich folks in America, they don't, you know, it doesn't matter to them what gets imported. But it does matter to low-income people, because if the imports from China, if the cheap stuff from China doesn't come in any longer, then the cost of living is going to go up for the low-wage people. It sounds logical. And in fact, he wraps it up. He says, the reality is if we toughen our trade relations with China, the benefits will be enjoyed by a few, since only a small percentage of Americans now work for companies that completely compete directly with Chinese manufacturing, while average Americans will feel the pain in the form of higher prices more quickly than the rich Americans will. And he says, Obama and Clinton are pushing these policies that will hurt working Americans. And I say, nonsense, because this is the corporate line. And what they're overlooking is the fact that if we stop importing these things from China, that doesn't mean that there won't be demand for them any longer. There will still be demand for them, so we start making them here. And what does that mean? All of a sudden, we've got good-paying manufacturing jobs in the United States. In other words, I don't mind paying 20% more for stuff made at Walmart if my paycheck is 40% bigger as a manufacturing labor. Where this is the bottom line. So these guys are out there. I'm telling you, the Democratic Party has been infiltrated by these people as well, who are saying, "Oh no, we got to have free trade. You couldn't go back to protectionism." I'm sorry. The only way to save this economy, the only thing essentially that built our economy. We had tariffs, huge tariffs, in the founding of this country up until the 1980s. And as the tariffs fell off, guess what? Off went the jobs. It's real simple, really.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at
4 minutes past the hour. Our phone number 1-866-303-2270. You want to drop by our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com. If you want to see our video stream, you can find that over at AirAmerica.com. There's also a link at TomHartman.com to that, a hot link to that. And, boy, a lot going on. Len in New York, New York. Hey, Len, you think treasury investments are a bad idea?
Yeah, he was telling people to invest in those treasury bonds. Which are
the inflation-adjusted ones, yeah. But they only go up at the rate of the CPI.
There's two problems, right. Number one, you're giving your money away for a promise for dollars in the future, which are being eaten up by inflation constantly. Number two is that the numbers that they use to compute the CPI are completely distorted.
Well, that was the point he was making. In fact, he was the guy who originally made those points, and then Kevin Phillips quoted him in his book. So what's, in your mind, what's an alternative?
Well, you know, I was listening to somebody's very wise investment advice amongst your own ad on the radio.
Buy gold.
I mean, you've got to mix it up between gold and foreign currencies and stocks and foreign currencies, you know, that own physical assets that are going to hold some value.
Yeah, in other words, the bottom line, Len, is that because America has been stripped of its manufacturing capacity, because we've been hollowed out, we've become an economy where basically we're saying, do you want fries with that? There's nothing of value left in the United States, so anybody who wants to invest rationally has to move offshore as well.
The other aspect of it is just the way, the recklessness, the total recklessness of the budget deficits. I remember somewhere in March, I happened to hear on the radio that because tax receipts were lower than they anticipated in February, and the spending that was going on, that in February alone, now this isn't, you can't multiply this by 12, but it gives you an idea of the sharp, you know, points at the top of this graph that keeps rising in terms of our deficits. In February alone, the government took in $170 billion less than it spent. So if you would multiply that, that would be $2 trillion for the year. Now, that's not what it's implying because it's a skewed number. But, you know, if it's $600 billion a year, $700, between that and the money that our private enterprise, meaning you and me, are spending on oil in excess of what we're taking, and we're creating $1 trillion a year or so of, you know, of dollars that people
30 years of Reaganomics has created a bankrupt nation. That's the bottom line. I remember when
supply side economics.
Yeah, absolutely right. Len, thank you very much. I remember back when Reagan was pushing this stuff, was pushing this Kool-Aid, and people would say, hey, it makes great sense. You know, cut taxes and borrow money and the deficit doesn't matter. As Dick Cheney said, Ronald Reagan taught us the deficits don't matter. Well, and people would say to me, you know, hey, the economy's great under Reagan. I mean, there was that one serious recession, but toward the end of his administration, I'm going, you know, give me a credit card with $1 million line of credit on it. I'll show you what it looks like to live large. It was all smoke and mirrors, and now the chickens are coming home to roost. John in San Francisco. Hey, John.
Hi, Tom. I heard you yesterday with Peter Yarrow, and you were talking about Colin Powell. In glowing terms,
he was. I was. He was. I was not.
Well, you've mentioned before about reconciliation, and I think we're leaving the truth out of the truth and reconciliation.
You're not speaking for me, John. I think that if we were gonna do something like the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it would have to be pretty much identical, where people come forward and say, "Yeah, this is the crime that I committed."
Yes.
And acknowledge it.
And I think that to talk about Colin Powell as a man of integrity, as we still seem to do, Gore Vidal talks about us as the United States of amnesia.
Yeah. And well, as Peter Yarrow did yesterday. Again, I did not say that, and you can I may be wrong, but I don't think that you will find any quotes from me endorsing Colin Powell. Colin Powell blew his credibility when he stood up in the United Nations and gave that speech that there's a fair body of evidence now that he knew was bogus.
Yes.
I just, you know, I'm not there for Colin Powell, and I never have been. John, I got to move along, but thank you very much for your point. Mike in Los Angeles. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. Hey, listen. You know, everybody talks about drilling up in Alaska and opening up the oil.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Where does oil go that's already coming out of there? If I remember
it's going
right,
to China.
If I remember right, back in the times, about 4 or 5 years ago, most of it was being exported to Japan.
Yeah, and to China now as well. Most of the oil from I don't know the exact percentage, and a lot of that was pre-pipeline, but a lot of the oil that's coming out of Alaska and out of the North Slope and northern Canada is going to Asia. Asia is a huge consumer of oil, and they pay very good prices. And yeah, absolutely. And see, this is the thing, and good point, Mike. Thank you for making it. Is that this whole let's drill in Anwar thing is not about solving an oil supply problem in the United States. It's about making more profits for ExxonMobil, that is, and other companies, but principally ExxonMobil, that is propping up a bunch of conservative politicians, James Inhofe and others, who are living off campaign contributions and lobbying contributions from these giant oil companies. I mean, it's just plain old flat out wrong. John in Buffalo, New York. Hey, John.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
I just want to thank you for being one of the talk show and pundits who play it straight. I find it really disconcerting when I hear people on the left who stretch facts and just want to fit their arguments, and I seldom hear you do that.
Thank you, I think.
Moving on here.
Not sure what that means.
Is we could possibly remove via impeachment and prosecute some Supreme Court justices and what we do about the judicial system.
It is, you know, the Constitution does provide for the impeachment of Supreme Court justices, and the problem is you would have to find them guilty. You would have to have the articles of impeachment drawn in the House and then find them guilty in the Senate of high crimes and misdemeanors. And I would argue that probably the only thing that five members of the Supreme Court, and one of them's dead now, so four members of the Supreme Court, and actually one of them's no longer on the court, so three members of the sitting court who are it could be impeached, have done in the last, near term, the last decade or so that is impeachable is Bush v. Gore, because
right.
they explicitly said this is not precedent. In other words, this is not a real decision. That is, so wrong. I think that rises to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors against the Constitution. But John, it's the unfortunate reality is that there's just no bite for impeachment right now in the House of Representatives, and Nancy Pelosi's not going to push it. Although Dennis Kucinich put the thing out, but it got dumped into committee. I mean, it just got buried. The political calculus right now, and apparently the Obama campaign is promoting this, the political calculus right now is let's look forward, let's get a huge majority in Congress, let's talk about the positive vision for America and a positive agenda, and also let's hold these guys accountable in the next session of Congress. And if they include the whole let's hold these guys accountable, and I think all of us have to be working to make sure that they are held accountable in the next session of Congress. If they include that, and Barack Obama has apparently said, we did have this one news story one day, like 3 weeks ago, and then it kind of, vanished into the void, where he said, yes, he would pursue the investigations and encourage continuing investigations if they are held accountable. I think that, bottom line, I think it would be a good thing. Ray in Sun City, Arizona. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Yeah, you're on the air, Ray. What's up?
Tom, I can't tell you how much I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I just finished your book, Screwed, and I think you're a great writer.
Thank you.
I believe that you ought to write a book about Ronald Reagan.
Well, that book, Screwed, is basically the book on Ronald Reagan. I mean, it's easy.
Well, it is a lot about it. Yeah, there's no question. But this myth that Republicans like to float about the great Ronald Reagan, it should be blown apart.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I tried to do, and thank you, Ray, for that. I tried to do that in Screwed and take on the Reagan myth. And, there are other people who have written other books about Reagan, Sleepwalking Through History by Haynes Johnson and a few others that are pretty good overviews of, although I don't think that a really good dissection of his presidency has been done from the left. There are all these celebratory books on the right, but not on the left. 866-303-2270, our phone number. Maria in Chicago. Hey, Maria.
Hi, Tom. I want to thank you for your program. It's great.
Thank you.
And all that all the many books you've written. I just wanted to know if you were aware. I came across an article that I had saved from last year in the Chicago Tribune, dated May 7th, 2007.
Uh-huh.
And in it, our senior senator, Dick Durbin, said that he was on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and they knew that going to war was a lie. And he said they were all sworn to silence, secrecy. And it's pretty upsetting to know that they knew.
Durbin's admitted that? I mean, that makes Durbin impeachable.
Well, they were all sworn to secrecy, and he...
By whom? I mean, what's the higher power that can say to a U.S. senator, you shall violate the Constitution?
I know. So this article was pretty an eye-opener.
Yeah, Maria, please, if you can send that to me, I'd appreciate it. My contact information's on our website at tomhartman.com, and I would love to see that. I find it surprising. I know that a number of the members of the Intelligence Committee have talked about how they felt like they were being lied to, or they felt like maybe they were being deceived, or that they knew that they were getting partial information. But man, that's it. Or actually, even better than emailing it to me, post it on our blog. Just go over to tomhartman.com and for today's show, post it on the blog for today's show if you've got a link to it. And perhaps somebody in the chat room will be digging that out pretty soon. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Taking my country back. We have
got a bundle in a treasure drawer, more than there had ever been before. But every day we're drowning deeper in debt, makes you wonder where those tax dollars went. Now my state is red and my collar's blue, yellow ribbon on the tailgate of my Ford. Is this support the troops? And Lord knows I do. Let's bring them home before we lose one more.
There you go, taking our country back. One Senate seat at a time, one House seat at a time, one state Senate seat at a time, one state assembly or House seat at a time, one local, one county seat at a time, one dog catcher at a time. What? Right across the board. We need to be taking our country back. We need to be energizing people at the level of local politics. And on this show, we try to highlight people who are doing just that, people who have stepped out and said, I will participate. Gary Pritchard is with us. PRITCHARD08.com is his website, GaryPritchard08.com. And he is a dedicated educator in the public school system, as it says in the on his website. And he's running as a Democratic candidate for the California State Senate from Senate District 33. That's running against California Republican Assemblywoman Mimi Walters. And Gary, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be on.
Great to have you here with us. And I, you know, again, these semi-local, I mean, it's relatively local from a national audience. Races are important. And I think people all over the country who want to support progressives should check out your website at GaryPritchard08.com and make a contribution. Gary, tell us about your candidacy.
Yeah, I'm probably like most of your listeners. I got into politics mostly on the federal level. And so I was interested in presidential elections. But as you kind of stated, I mean, everything that I know to be changeable within my district and within my community really rests at the public or at the local level. And
yes.
I think a lot of people kind of forget about that in election cycles. So I'm trying to raise awareness about local elections and the importance of really picking the correct state candidates, as well as you said, city council, frog catchers, and whatever else. It's really important.
I mean, right on down the line. And the person that you're running against,
yes.
Tell us about this race.
Okay. Well, Mimi Walters is a pretty right-wing Republican in the sense that she's like most legislators up in Sacramento. She votes no most of the time on everything that the Democratic majority agrees that's good and sort of valuable within our community. So she is very difficult, I believe, to work with. Today Leon Panetta said in the LA Times that the thing that he felt that was the most pressing for the legislation was the fact that no one really talks to one another.
Right.
And that there needs to be sort of a greater sense of awareness of what the other side's doing. And with the gerrymandering that goes on in California and the idea that all the seats are sort of safe, held seats, there's really no one that runs towards the general election. So you don't really have a really strong debate. The ideas that are tested within the party sort of favor that of anybody that's sort of outside of the party. And I don't think you get a very fair representation. Most of the senatorial districts, congressional districts, and assembly districts, I think it's well over 30% to 40% margin in who wins the election. And that usually happens well before the primary. I mean,
so Gary Pritchard, 08.com, by the way, the website. We're talking with Gary Pritchard. He's running for the California State Senate. If you're running for the Senate and she was an assemblywoman,
yeah.
Does that mean that this is an open seat?
It is an open seat, absolutely.
Okay.
So it was term limits got the incumbent out, and so now it's completely open. It's between me and Mimi.
Right, and she's looking for a raise, and you want to take that seat.
I want that seat so bad. Yeah.
Yeah, and you're just very quickly your campaign agenda. Just give us your elevator speech.
Mostly it centers around the budget. That's the main thing about California is that we have this huge deficit, a lot of spending, and no one seems to be able to make headway. There are not very moderate, very many moderates up in Sacramento, so it makes it really difficult to come to some kind of consensus. Nothing really gets put on the table, so everybody sort of, you know, cloisters in their own party. And I'm trying to go towards a more centrist approach. And I'm out knocking on doors, and I'm talking to Republicans, trying to get them to see our side of things before the general election. And I'm kind of pleased that I've actually turned some of those Republicans over to us. So I think the seat is really up, but no one's really kind of, you know, campaigned hard after the primaries. They just assume that it'll go to the incumbent or to the Republican or the incumbent
right.
in Orange County.
Because this is a conservative district.
Oh, it's very conservative, yeah.
Yeah.
True.
So,
but like I say, I mean, even the conservatives down there are really kind of dissatisfied with their leadership. So
I would think so.
Yeah,
Gary, good luck. Gary, good luck. Gary Pritchard, PRITCHARD08.com is the website. And Gary, thanks a lot. I'm going to move along, grab a couple calls here before we wrap this show up in the next minute. But thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much, Tom. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, good luck, and great talking with you. Let's see, Alan in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Alan, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom. Last night I was listening to Mike Malloy, and he had somebody on the show that said that somebody had written an article in Slate.com yesterday, and I didn't catch the author's name, about Nancy Pelosi threatening John Conyers with his chairmanship if he continues with any type of...
That actually came out about 4 months ago, as I recall. The suggestion that was the case. I don't know that it's ever been confirmed, but I've heard that story
what I was trying to say is that if she knew about this stuff or is complicit in any of this too, then she's guilty along with the rest of them.
Yeah.
And at
what point? I mean, there's. This is really a tough one, Al, because do we have absolute purity and lose an election? If their calculus is right, do we have absolute purity and lose an election, or do we say we did the right thing, or do we say we will do the right thing a little later down the road and keep the election? I mean, if those are the choices, which do you do, Alan?
To the Constitution, parts of the Constitution, the whole
Okay, so you go for the absolute purity.
Exactly.
Tom Hartman.
Helping you win the water cooler wars.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Listening to Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. The Libertarian Party has had its party, its nominating convention, and they have decided that the former Republican congressman from Georgia, Bob Barr, is going to represent the party. BobBarr2008.com is his website. And Bob Barr, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be with you all once again.
Yeah, good to have you back here with us. You know, there are some areas, and I think we both know them, where we starkly agree and where we starkly disagree. And I'd like to touch on some of both of those if we can today. In an area where I suspect that we probably both starkly agree, today's Supreme Court decision saying, sorry, the Constitution says habeas corpus is habeas corpus.
This is a tremendously important decision. I was, as many Americans who pay attention to these issues like yourself were a year and a half ago, distressed to see the then Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez, appear before the Senate of the United States and basically stake out the position that habeas corpus is no longer considered a fundamental right by this administration,
right.
And yet there was no public outcry. At least we have this decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, one would have hoped it would have been a 9-0 decision rather than a 5-4 decision, but at least they very clearly now have enunciated the standard, and that is that habeas corpus is a fundamental right and cannot be arbitrarily or cavalierly taken away from somebody detained by the United States in its territory.
Well, and in fact, the Constitution says habeas corpus shall not be suspended but upon insurrection or invasion, as I recall the language.
Correct.
And uprising or invasion, something like that. And it's just mind-boggling, which raises the question, from the libertarian perspective, or from Bob Barr's perspective, what do we do about people who have grossly violated their constitutional oath. George W. Bush, the Bush administration. I mean, you led the floor. You were one of the floor leaders for the impeachment of Bill Clinton. It seems to me that at the very least we have impeachable acts, violations of the Constitution, not just by George W. Bush, but I would argue by we still have three members of the Supreme Court who were sitting in 2000 when Bush v. Gore was issued, which was, in my opinion, unconstitutional. I mean, they essentially said in the decision, this decision cannot be used as precedent, which is like saying that they're stepping outside of what their rights are. And the Constitution clearly says the states will decide what electors they're sending, not the Supreme Court. For example, I mean, how do we hold accountable from Colin Powell to George Bush to Dick Cheney for the war in Iraq and for you know, these strange decisions on the Supreme Court? What are your thoughts on that?
Congress has failed miserably under both Republican and Democrat leadership in recent years to fulfill its obligation in terms of both general oversight of the executive branch to ensure that the laws passed by the Congress are carried out by the executive appropriately and with due deference to the intent of the Congress. One Congress after another has failed to conduct appropriate oversight. It doesn't matter whether it's Republican or Democrat. Both of them are bad at it. And secondly, the American people don't demand that the Congress conduct proper oversight. And that means to conduct inquiries to determine whether there is evidence of impeachable offenses. The American people can't do it directly. We can't have a citizens' court. The mechanism is provided in the Constitution. Congress has to do that. In order for there to be articles of impeachment crafted or even an appropriate inquiry of impeachment, there has to be some evidence. You know, we don't want people just shooting from the hip. Right. And that's the job of the Congress. And Congress has simply not done that. They have not inquired into the specifics, for example, of what appears to be the unlawful eavesdropping on American citizens by this administration, and into the work of the telecommunications companies in carrying out those surveillances, mm-hmm. In order to determine whether or not there is evidence of an impeachable offense there.
Right. For example, I think, yeah, one of many. Kucinich listed 35 of them a couple of days ago. The libertarians we're experiencing right now. A problem with tomatoes. It's you know, a general freakout across the United States about tomatoes. Here in the Pacific Northwest, I'm broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, and in Oregon and Washington State, when the lettuce E. coli scare happened half a year ago or thereabouts, both states, I believe, I know Washington State did, I believe Oregon did as well, put into place inspections on the ground at the sites, you know, had state inspectors going out and testing irrigation water for fecal contamination or bacterial contamination so that we know that agricultural produce produced in the Pacific Northwest is actually safe. There are no unsafe locally grown tomatoes coming out of the Pacific Northwest. We can guarantee that. Libertarians, by and large, if this were being done by the federal government, would be opposed to this. Am I correct?
You know, probably most libertarians would be, you know, to let the marketplace prevail. Personally, I think there is an appropriate role for government to carry out such inspections because there are some things that it is absolutely impossible, not just unfeasible, but impossible for the consuming public, the average consumer, to determine whether or not something is safe, and by the time the average consumer might be able to determine that, they might be dead. You know, right. And then, you know, sure, you have a right in the courts, but, you know, it ain't gonna help.
So you're a liberal on this issue. I mean, this, because the libertarian perspective, you know, having been there, I mean, you know, 20 years ago inside that party, the libertarian perspective is the government should basically be running the police and the army, and that's it. Get the hell out of everything else. And let the market fix it all.
But Well, there are all sorts of jokes about, libertarians and, how few people it takes to screw in a light bulb. It takes no libertarians because they let the free market do it.
Right.
And so forth.
Well, my comment is that libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid, because, libertarians are opposed to laws that would prevent prostitution being legal and that would criminalize drugs. But on the other hand, the Republican Party, to a large extent, they talk at least about doing away with federal programs. But it sounds to me like...
And there are a lot of federal programs and federal agencies that do need to be done away with. And this is where all libertarians can agree, even though there might be differences on, how far to go in some areas. And I think this is reflective of the fact that they nominated Bob Barr, as opposed to some of their other nominees, candidates, for the presidential nomination. We all agree on the need to dramatically downsize and reduce the scope, the power, the size, and the cost of the federal government.
Well, where would you do that?
Many of these issues, such as, you're talking about proper an inspection of a food crop, for example, can be handled much more appropriately by state and local governments, not by the federal government, for example. So in a lot of areas, the libertarians, what I would try and do as president and begin doing as president, is at least start getting a lot of these powers that are exercised terribly inefficiently and way too costly by the federal government back to state and local governments.
So what would happen is ultimately that if somebody had the misfortune of being born in West Virginia as opposed to being born in New York State, that their schools would be less standard, their food would be less safe because the tax base in West Virginia is lower than that in New York State, and so the resources and services provided by that government of that state, I mean, you're essentially going back before the Civil War, before the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Are you not?
No, I think that's a gross oversimplification.
But before the Civil War, we had strong states and weak federal government. After the Civil War, we had a strong federal government and weak states.
Well, the real tremendous growth of the federal government occurred later on in the 19th century. I think not so much right after the Civil War. That had something to do with it, certainly.
Yeah.
But it was
most of it after World War One. Yeah.
During beginning in the so-called Gilded Age, the industrialization of the country, and then certainly early in the 20th century, it just took off
right.
Under both Republicans like Teddy Roosevelt and Democrats like Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah.
But there are going to be differences among how the different states handle certain public policy matters, and that's a basic principle of federalism. And I think that's to be supported and applauded.
Let's discuss. Can you stick around for another segment?
Just one more segment.
Great. Okay, Bob Barr. I would like to discuss federalism with you and find out what the libertarian philosophy is on that. Bob Barr. Let's see, BobBarr2008.com, by the way, the website, and, of course, the Libertarian Party. We'll be right back, 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman.
Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I don't want millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Won't you give me back my job again?
20 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Bob Barr, the Libertarian Party's nominee for President of the United States. BobBarr2008.com. And Bob, I'm assuming the Libertarian Party, what is it, libertarian.org?
LP.org.
LP.org. Okay, great. Thank you very much. I'm looking at the historical budget data published by the CBO.gov, the Congressional Budget Office, and from 1962 to today, year by year, 62 we were 5.9% off budget in terms of the deficit. I mean, it was less than 10% off budget, and that held right up through 75. Then it went into the range of around 40% off budget up until Reagan came into office. Starting with the Reagan years, it started hitting 120%, 207%, 83%, 221%, 85%, 237%, 86%, hitting 300% in the 90s until we got to 1999, where we were back to 1.9% positive. These are all negative numbers. 1.9% positive. In other words, a balanced budget, and then a surplus in 2000, 83%. Now we're back. Now we're at 567.4, percent off. We have this massive deficit and debt associated with it. And you look at the numbers, and the only time that we had a balanced budget was when Bill Clinton came in and said, "Okay, we're going to raise taxes by a few points," and it actually helped the economy. What's wrong with doing that?
Well, the fact of the matter is we had a balanced budget during those few years when we had two different parties in power. You had the Republican majority that came in the 94 election in the House and the Senate, and a Democrat president that, for whatever faults he might have had, Bill Clinton is a very bright man and recognized that the American public was tired of deficit spending. It became a real issue. And even though we had a great deal of back and forth between the budgets that we were passing and the spending bills and the president, and he vetoed some and sent them back, at the end of the day, in 1997, what made the difference was the Balanced Budget Act that was passed then and the welfare reform. And Bill Clinton was enough of a realist to know that even though he might not have agreed with all of it, it was in the best interest of the country to sign that bill into law. And that's what really made the difference.
I'm looking at the numbers here. Our the total income to the country, $1.6 trillion, 97, $1.652 trillion, 98, $1.7 trillion, 99. And then you get up, the income was steadily going up. Outlays were steadily going up. It's just that income surpassed outlays for the first time in 98.
Yeah.
So, we're
saying the same thing.
What I'm saying is I don't see outlays never went down. You said that this was the result of budget cutting. There's, the numbers are for federal spending are consistently and steadily going up. Increased taxes, revenues went up faster.
I really don't think it's relevant to get into an argument over that. The bottom line is where we had government power, where you had competing interests and competing philosophies, different parties in control, and you did have a combination of cuts in spending. Now, they might not have been the kind of cuts that I would have voted for that were deep, true cuts, but you had decreases in the growth of government spending. You did have also, as part of the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, you had cuts in the rate of taxation on capital gains. That spurred economic growth. You had a good and positive combination of a number of different factors that gave rise to fiscal responsibility for a brief shining moment in time.
Right, but wasn't one of the major – my point was that the major factor was that we said, okay, this is what our tax rates have to be in order to pay – have income.
I mean, if you're saying that the way to improve the economy is to raise taxes, no, I will not buy
that. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
No,
okay.
Absolutely.
All right. So
not.
We disagree with it. So where would you cut? I'm looking at the federal budget here, and I don't see anything that's more than just a couple of percent that's not Department of Defense, HHS, or the Treasury.
Well, I'm not quite sure what you're looking at, but the Department of Education takes a not insignificant chunk of the budget. I'd be hard pressed to find where in our constitutional or our historical form of government there is justification for the federal government to be spending tens of billions of dollars on education policy, which is and should be returned as a power to state and local governments.
Right. The Department of Education is about $60 billion. That's the area where you would say, for example, but $60 billion is a drop in the bucket.
Well, you got to start somewhere, Tom. I mean, one could look at that and become very frustrated and cynical and say, gee, there's nothing we can do. Everything's just too big. But you've got to start somewhere. As president, one thing I would do immediately would be to issue an order for a 10% decrease in spending in the executive office of the president. That is something that a president has some control over. And send two messages immediately to the Congress of the United States on taking office in January of 2009. One would be Don't bother sending me any bill that purports to raise the debt ceiling because it will be vetoed. Now, if you want to override the veto, people know exactly where the spendthrifts are, and that is in the Congress, not in the White House, and send another message to the Congress that no appropriations bill that increases spending over the previous year will be, likewise, will not be signed into law.
Yeah, okay. Libertarian Party candidate Bob Barr, bobbarr2008.com, lp.org, the websites. Bob, thanks for dropping by today.
Always a pleasure, Tom. Look forward to it again.
Thank you. It is 26 minutes past the hour. Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress coming up with us. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at
866-303-2270. The lady that I know just came from Colombia. She smiled because I did not understand. Then she held out some marijuana. Uh-huh. She said it was the best in all the land. And I said, no, 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 I don't smoke it no more. I'm tired of waking up on the floor.
No,
thank you, please.
So I understand getting stronger and stronger. Well, here's the, it's strange. Strange news out of Amsterdam, actually out of Holland. They have passed anti-smoking laws in Holland. So coffee shops where people traditionally go to smoke cigarettes or smoke pot legally are going to go all non-smoking. And there's all this uproar about it. And the Prime Minister said coffee shops will be treated in the same manner as any other catering business. It would be wrong to move toward a smoke-free catering industry and then make an exception for coffee shops. The one exception to the law, though, is that it only applies to tobacco. So, you can, as the article in Der Spiegel Online says, smoking pot or hashish in coffee shops will remain legal. It just can't be mixed with tobacco. If someone wants to roll their joint with tobacco, they have to smoke it outside. Christy Harvey is with us, the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress and editor of MikeCheckRadio.org, AmericanProgress.org. Hey, Christy.
I love that story. Only in Amsterdam would you, you know, have a cop come up to you and say, is that a cigarette?
Right.
Oh,
exactly.
Oh, it's a joint. You're fine.
Exactly. I mean, that's how it's going to play out.
That is hysterical. How are you?
I'm great. How are you today?
I am fine. Thank you.
It was nice to see you in New York last week.
Yes, that was a lot of fun. It was just too brief.
Yeah, and that piece about Joe Madison and our trip to Sudan was just brilliantly put together by the folks at Talk Radio News and Talkers Magazine.
It really was. I was so moved by that entire, there was, you know, the show about you guys there, and I hadn't realized, I thought you guys really had gone and just done shows down there. I hadn't realized how much humanitarian work that you all did on that trip, and that was just, it was a wonderful, wonderful story.
Of the week that we were there, actually, I only did one day on the air, and that was by satellite phone. And,
right.
Standing in the dark with a headlamp on where they're saying, turn your lamp off, it makes you a target for the snipers.
Right.
It was weird.
Oh, man.
In any case, to the news of the day, you're our kind of under-the-radar person here. By the way, before I get into this, I want to play for you this piece from Dick Durbin. Somebody called earlier and mentioned it, and now I remember, actually, we talked about it at some length a year ago when he said this on the floor of the Senate, that the Intelligence Committee had been lied to. Let me just share this audio with you.
A few hundred feet away from here, in a closed room, carefully guarded, the Intelligence Committee was meeting on a daily basis for top secret briefings about the information we were receiving, and the information we had in the Intelligence Committee was not the same information being given to the American people. I couldn't believe it. Members of this administration were in active, heated debate over whether aluminum tubes really meant that the Iraqis were developing nuclear weapons. Some within the administration saying, of course not, it's not the same kind of aluminum tube. At the same time that members of the administration were telling the American people to be fearful of mushroom-shaped clouds. I was angry about it. Frankly, I couldn't do much about it. Because you see, in the Intelligence Committee, we're sworn to secrecy. We can't walk outside the door and say, the statement made yesterday by the White House is in direct contradiction to classified information that's being given to this Congress. We can't do that. We couldn't make those statements.
Now, Durbin goes on to point out, and to his credit, that he voted no on that authorization.
Right.
But he could have walked out and said, this contradicts classified information. He just couldn't have released the classified information, or am I missing something?
No, I think that you're right. I don't know what the legal ramifications are for even just saying that it didn't match up. But I was really, I vaguely remembered that too when that phase two report came out last week, which didn't really go anywhere, did it?
No.
You know, I've been waiting for that. We all have for so long.
Yeah.
And the White House was very easily able to just say, oh, there's nothing new here. To which I said, well, it's still corrupt.
Yeah, and they lied. I mean, you know, the phase two of the intelligence report was, you know, that the Bush administration lied to us. I mean, just unambiguously lied to us. And so, you know, we've been having a bit of a discussion. I have a feeling it's going to develop over the next few weeks and months about whether, you know, what's the appropriate path. Obviously, we're not, unfortunately, in my opinion, but nonetheless, I think it's pretty clear we're not going to have impeachment in this legislative session. So in the next legislative session, under a new president, hopefully Barack Obama, should there be a truth and reconciliation kind of process? This is what Peter Yarrow proposed on my program yesterday. Peter, Paul, and Mary, he's out, you know, quite an activist out there. And where the point is, I think that they did that in South Africa because that's what it took to get people who are holding power to surrender power.
Right.
And we've got people holding power right now, and there will be many of these people continuing to hold power into next year because they're members of the House and the Senate, and or because they're simply moving from the administration into other areas where they hold power, who will have the power to obstruct anything like, you know, criminal indictments. So what South Africa did was say, okay, we just want to put this era behind us. We want to make sure that the rules change. We want to make sure this never happens again. Or do we push hard for, you know, let's throw these bums in jail?
Well, exactly. And, you know, it gets very legal and very tricky. You know, what makes common sense to me, which is, of course, you put people in jail when they abuse their power, when they come out and they say things like the mushroom cloud and forget conveniently to say, well, you know, there's four people who agree with us. Everyone else says that we're wrong.
Yeah, there is a footnote on this. Yes.
Exactly. I think that's especially using your position as the president of the United States, which, you know, love him or hate him, it still carries a great weight of responsibility and respectability. And you tend to believe what people like the Secretary of Defense tell you.
Yeah.
And so I think abusing that is, but that said, you know, the law around that gets just so tricky and twisted and weird, and I don't even pretend to be a legal scholar.
Yeah,
so
I just think that we need to be holding the next administration and the next Congress accountable in a very big way and pushing them for figuring this stuff out.
Well,
anyhow, let's move along if we can.
Absolutely.
Unless you wanted to wrap that up or comment.
Well, the only thing I was going to say is we did see a small step taken today with the Supreme Court decision. The Supreme Court did rule, of course, that Guantanamo detainees can challenge their detention under habeas corpus, which, as we all know, has been around since, the Magna Carta.
Mm-hmm.
And so they upheld that. And I was pleasantly surprised. I was glad that that shook down in the way that it was supposed to.
Yeah. And me too. And the problem is that it was a 5-4 decision.
Right.
By the way, that was put forward by that case was brought forward by Ellen Ratner's brother, Michael Ratner's organization, the Center for Constitutional Rights. Their website, ccrjustice.org. It cost them a ton of money to do this thing. And I just want to encourage all my listeners to go to ccrjustice.org and help them out. They're great people. FEMA, wait. Hold on, wait. Or is this, you're still saying Katrina victims need basic supplies?
This is the thing. Katrina had tons and tons of these household goods and products, like kitchen goods and pillows and blankets and that sort of thing for Hurricane Katrina victims. And they had a sort of backlog in distributing these to people because they didn't have the enough people working for FEMA to pass these things out. So all of these supplies were being stored in these great big warehouses. And it was FEMA was spending $1 million a year to store this stuff as opposed to paying to pass it out to a lot of these Katrina victims who honestly still need the help.
Why?
And
why didn't they pass it out?
They just, you know, there was a log jam. They didn't have the people to pass it out. And, you know, people down in New Orleans were saying, we need this stuff. And so FEMA decided just to give it away to other people. And they got rid of and just sort of said, we don't want this anymore because we don't want to pay to store it. And we can't figure out how to pass it out, figure out who needs this the most down in New Orleans. So they just, quote unquote, what they're saying is they vacated it.
I think that this administration shares the libertarian philosophy that the role of government in things like helping people should be zero.
Right.
And that's why they've been obstructionist and incompetent at this. I don't think, frankly, it's incompetence at all. If they wanted to pass it out, they could do it.
Though I'll tell you something. If ExxonMobil needed a couple of blankets and a pillow,
they would have gotten it. Yeah.
FEMA would have
yesterday.
Been clicking and clacking along. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Unemployment. And the House fell just 3 votes short of a 2-thirds majority needed to pass unemployment insurance benefits extensions. This
exactly.
is a
and
big deal.
Yeah, this is a very big deal, and I was very disappointed in this, but the House has been trying to extend the amount of time that you can, if you're unemployed, receive unemployment benefits,
right.
Especially with the economy tanking as it has been. A lot more people need them for longer, and the Republicans led a big fight against it, and they did fall 3 votes short yesterday and were not able to push it through.
Now, was this is in the House of Representatives 3 votes short, so they had a lot of Democrats who were voting against this.
Yeah. They had all of the Democrats and some Republicans, but they needed 3 more votes to get to the 2-thirds to pass this through.
Why did it take 2-thirds?
Because the White House, of course, has said they would veto.
Oh, to have a veto-proof majority.
To have a veto-proof majority.
But the legislation then actually did pass, right?
It just
will be vetoed?
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Christy Harvey, the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, and MikeCheckRadio.org. Christy, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks so much.
Good talking with you.
You too.
At 45 minutes past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. We'll be back, and I believe with Ellen Ratner. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Like the water from our sink, they say it's not safe to drink. You gotta go and buy it at the store. Now we're told there's a hole in the ozone. Look what's washing on the beach. And Lord, I believe from the heavens to the sea, we're bringing Mother Nature to her knees. Let's leave some blue.
That sounds like a plan. Indeed, 9.5 minutes before the hour. By the way, we have a winner in our contest today for what you want to call it—a contest, or I don't know what you call it, but it's our little gig to figure out which post Sean thought was coolest. Is that a good word, Sean? I don't know.
That's a good way to put
okay.
it, Tom.
All right. So your favorite post for today over at TomHartman.com on our show blog.
Today's comes from Otto Mine, and it refers back to our first hour guest, who says, hearing Ralph Reed unable to admit the war and occupation of Iraq is wrong reminds me of one of my dad's favorite sayings. Beware of the person who sits in the front pew and sings the loudest. There sits the biggest crook in church.
Okay, great. And thank you so much. And thank you, Sean. And congratulations to
Otto Mine.
Otto Mine. There we go. Congratulations, Otto Mine. And thank you, Sean. And congratulations also to Michael Ratner. As I mentioned earlier, CCRjustice.org, Michael Ratner successfully took his case against this administration on behalf of Guantanamo detainees to the Supreme Court, and today won in a 5-4 decision. His sister, Ellen Ratner, who is with us almost every day, reporting the news of the day, Talk Radio, the president of Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Ellen, hey, welcome.
Well, it's so amazing. You know, Michael has worked day and night, and I can vouch for it. I've been, you know, on vacation with him up at the country, et cetera, while he's been working on these cases that have come before the Supreme Court and for the Center for Constitutional Rights. Tomorrow is his 65th birthday. We're having a family celebration, just a dinner tonight. So it's really wonderful. And if I can just do a little advertisement, Center for Constitutional Rights has information about the case, but also could use your contributions at CCRjustice.org.
Right.
But the case, you know, essentially what they did is they really used some of the opposition, Lindsey Graham and some other people's own words in their writings, in Justice Kennedy's writings, about why this should pertain and the Constitution. So it's a very clever trick. And in fact, Lindsey Graham, from as much as I 100% disagree with him on this, he's actually stopped me in the hall about a month ago and asked me how my brother was doing with his case.
That's so great.
So he's at least sort of open-minded to hearing about it. But
yeah. Well, I think that there are some there are some Republicans or conservatives who actually, and Lindsey Graham is an old JAG officer, you know, who actually, and I don't know his position on the Guantanamo thing, but I know
it's
that some of them
great,
are fairly principled. Oh, his is not. Yeah, okay.
But he, you know, he is, I mean, he certainly is open. He's not as rigid as some of these people are, mainly because he was an old JAG officer, I think.
Yeah.
And the court also said it's true that before today, the court has never held that non-citizens detained in our government and territory over which another country maintains, i.e. Cuba, have any rights under our Constitution. But the cases before us lack any precise historical parallel.
Right.
So, Justice Kennedy really sort of said, it was kind of angry, and he said multiple times that people have been held as long as 6 years, and of course he was joined by Stephen Souter, Ginsburg and Breyer, and the Gang of Four voted against him, and we all know who those people are.
Right, and you know, the Constitution, I mean, well, I've said it three times today. I don't need to read it again, but yeah, absolutely. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention the winner of our contest wins a copy of my book, Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. Forgive me for getting that in there, Ellen, but so what else is going on in Washington, D.C.?
A couple bad pieces of news. Jobless claims are up yet again, and the economists thought that there would be a smaller increase in terms of jobless people, but it rose more than 25,000, and it is basically a four-week moving average rose 2,500 to 371,500 people without a job. And to think that they're giving some grief about extending unemployment benefits.
Yeah, but the economy is just great, isn't it?
Pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Are you there, Todd?
I am. Are you there, Ellen? Ellen, I can hear you. Nope. We lost Ellen. Oh, my. So, okay, hopefully Ellen will call back and we will continue things with her. It's some interesting news out here, by the way, speaking of the news of the day. Will Lou Dobbs be the next governor of New Jersey? The New York Star Ledger is reporting this from the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org. Several well-connected Republicans have heard the buzz. We'll see. I kind of doubt it. Ellen, you're back with us. Yeah, we've got a minute left, Ellen. You want to finish the news.
Tom?
Yes.
One other interesting thing. Actually, the court did not find in a good way. They ruled unanimously against two citizens that were held in Iraq on terror charges. Mm-hmm. One of them was convicted to death, but that was actually changed. These were two Americans. They wanted to be able to challenge their detention in the U.S. court. And the court voted that Iraq is sovereign. Now, that may have other implications for Iraq, but it was unanimous.
Well, if the court voted that Iraq is sovereign, and Iraq has said that they want to be able to have a referendum on whether the U.S. stays there, oh, man, it's starting to get really complex, because there's also, the administration's also pitching this idea that if Iraq is a sovereign nation and they can demonstrate that Iran has attacked them, then we can attack Iran in response to that.
And yeah, I think that they voted more on sovereign than on the case, actually.
Interesting. Ellen Ratner, talkradionews.com. You can get all the details there. Ellen, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
And also ccrjustice.org as well. Coming up tomorrow, Friday the 13th. No need to fear. Bernie Sanders will be here. Brunch with Bernie. Anything goes Friday. 866-303-2270, our phone number. Write it down. We'll be taking your calls all day tomorrow. So, and don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.
That's T-H-O-M Hartman with two N's, radio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.